dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the War of Ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. A man I've had the privilege of working with over quite some time, as he has served in a variety of capacities in the United States government, and now with the National Institute for Public Policy, where he serves as a senior analyst, is Dr. Mark Schneider. He is, I believe, one of, if not the foremost expert in our country on a whole host of very, very important topics, especially those related to nuclear threats to our country, relative capabilities of foreign adversaries, and our own deterrent posture. He has studied these matters closely. He has served in senior positions throughout the U.S. government. I had the privilege of working with him a long time ago in the Defense Department, where he was one of the top hands in the Office of the Secretary of Defense with responsibility for forces policy, strategic defense and verification, arms control, and the like. He was also a member of the Foreign Service of the United States and has served on the State Department's policy planning staff. Mark Schneider, it is a thrill to have you with us, especially at a moment such as this, when some of the work that you've been doing is being, well, flashed, I think, in the headlines as a result of some rather worrying developments in Russia. Welcome back to Secure Freedom Radio, my friend.
Well, thank you very much, and thank you for having me on.
The pleasure truly is mine, Mark. Let me ask you about this incident that took place Thursday in the northern reaches of Russia involving, we believe, something called the Skyfall missile. That's the NATO designation for it. But I'm interested in you reminding us what you've said on this program before about this weapon and what you make of the latest developments.
Just after Putin went public with this thing, I characterized it as the craziest weapon ever to come out of Putin's Russia. And the reason for that is not only does this likely have a very low probability of success, but it's an environmental disaster because you're going to get a destruction of a functioning nuclear reactor on every flight test, whether or not it is successful or not. And the unsuccessful tests, like the one that was just conducted, have actually more potential to cause harm than a successful one. Reports of radiation releases and widespread contamination in Europe from these tests go back from, you know, just after the Putin announcement. This one is particularly significant because of the high level of radiation that got dumped on a Russian city. I mean, something like 200 times normal background, according to reports I've seen. I mean, it didn't last long, and it's not, you're not going to die from that level of exposure, but it could have, you know, long-term health effects. It's not a good thing.
They've been passing out iodine, I'm told, to try to mitigate those effects.
Worse than that, there's a run on iodine there because that's something that can reduce the absorption of certain radioactive isotopes into the body. So this is a serious thing. What scares me more than that is the mentality behind it, the belief you have to have weapons like this. Ordinary nuclear cruise missiles aren't okay for Vladimir. You know, he's got to have a, you know, super duper nuclear powered, nuclear armed cruise missile.
And Mark, what is the strategic rationale behind that? I get that it's odd and worrying, but is there some purpose that would be served by a nuclear powered cruise missile that might explain his fixation on it?
Well, I mean, they talk, and he stated this in his initial announcement, of the infinite range of this thing. That's true. I mean, if you get a nuclear power cruise missile to work, you're going to get essentially unlimited range, but you don't need it. So you're running the risks, and there are quite considerable risks in terms of the environmental impact, for nothing. For essentially nothing, something that can be done by an ordinary cruise missile.
Mark, I think one of the other things that he's pointed to, or his people have, is that this infinite range, if you will, enables this cruise missile to avoid detection, perhaps by coming at the target, the United States, presumably from some direction other than one we would be expecting, or enabling it to use other maneuvering capabilities to prevent its interception by our defenses. Talk us through that explanation.
Those are theoretical advantages. I mean, if you had a situation where the United States had massive redundant air defenses, that might come into play. But that's not the situation. We have virtually nothing. I mean, we measure air defense in our ability to intercept hijacked airliners, not to deal with a large-scale nuclear strike on the United States. And it's absolutely ridiculous to put money into a system like this and run the risks associated to it based on nothing more than paranoid fantasies about the United States and NATO.
Yeah. Mark, this leads to the next question, which is, as you've pointed out on this program and elsewhere, including your great work at the National Institute for Public Policy, this particular weapon system is just one of, I think you've said, 20 or 22 different missiles and bombers and other nuclear delivery systems that the Russians have been introducing in a wholesale modernization of their strategic triad. Just give us quickly, we have to take a short break here in a moment, but a quick appreciation of the immensity of this undertaking.
Well, the number changes every few months, but by my last count, they have 22 active strategic nuclear modernization programs, mainly new systems. A few of them are upgrades of legacy Soviet systems. But, I mean, it's totally unprecedented. No one, except for the Chinese and to a lesser extent in China, but still quite considerable. No one else is doing anything remotely like this, and their modernization programs are active right now. They've introduced, since 1997, probably over 10 new or modernized strategic nuclear systems. They got roughly the same number or slightly more under development right now. And the process is never going to end. It's not that they modernize and you know, sit on their laurels for 10 or 20 or 30 years. They finish deploying something. They've got a new follow-on system under development.
Yeah, hot production lines and very active test labs. Mark, we have to pause. When we come back, I want to talk to you about what we are doing in this regard and what it tells us about the state of the nuclear deterrent challenge we face. That and much, much more with Dr. Mark Schneider, straight ahead.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
We're back, I'm very pleased to say, with a second segment of our conversation with Dr. Mark Schneider, a remarkable, well, national treasure, I think of him as, in terms of his understanding of and articulation about the various challenges we're facing in the nuclear weapons domain. This is something of a lost art, I'm afraid, in this country. Mark, you've just described how very different that is in Russia. We'll talk about China in a moment. But Just to stay with Russia and the relative balance, I am very much struck, particularly in the aftermath of President Trump's sensible withdrawal from the Intermediate Range Nuclear Forces Treaty, which we worked on back in the day, that the seriousness of the United States, both the government itself to some extent, and certainly the policy elite more generally, and Congress and the press and so on, about nuclear capabilities, nuclear weapons, nuclear threats, is in such a diminished state that if the kind of thing that you were talking about in terms of the Russian military buildup had taken place during, say, the Cold War, we would be in full cry effort to develop and deploy corresponding and preferably superior capabilities. And yet we're instead, it seems, very much, as you sort of alluded to a moment ago, frozen like amber in a deterrent posture of decades ago, and very little in the way of a real modernization program underway, let alone, you know, now in place. Talk us through that, if you would, both the sort of historic, you know, peculiar nature of our posture at the moment and its implications.
Well, you're absolutely right. You go back to the 50s and 60s, Congress was extremely supportive of nuclear deterrence. As late as the 1990s, U.S. law, and this was enacted in the 1990s, prohibited us from making unilateral reductions in our strategic nuclear force below 6,000 deployed strategic nuclear weapons as counted in the Star Treaty, unless the Russians ratified the Star II Treaty, which called for additional reductions. I mean, today you have just the opposite. You have the Congress trying to reward the House of Representatives trying to reward the Russians for violating the INF Treaty and the Open Skies Treaty by prohibiting any U.S. response to their violations. At most right now in the Democratic Party, you have support of minimum deterrence and some significant number, maybe even majority of the Democrats in the House don't even support that. You have extreme positions, and a lot of it is highly prevalent in the inside the Beltway establishment on, you know, the nuclear zero fantasy. And it is a total fantasy. China, for example, just announced that it's not going to engage in nuclear arms control. And that doesn't seem to have affected the nuclear zero crowd at all. Because basically, it's unbelievable. Basically, all they want to do is reduce our forces. And they operate on the premise that, you know, really nasty guys like Vladimir Putin can be deterred by a puny and inferior nuclear force.
Mm-hmm. And obsolescent nuclear force at that, which is kind of the point here, is we have, Mark, you've warned about this for years. We have, particularly in the aftermath of abandoning periodic underground nuclear testing, been relying ever more on, you know, simulations and computer modeling to satisfy ourselves that we still have a viable deterrent, let alone an effective one. And I have to say, I'm increasingly skeptical that that's the case, and worried that our adversaries, whether it's Russia or China, or who knows, maybe even the North Koreans or Iran, may find our deterrent incredible and therefore not be deterred by it. Your thoughts?
Yes, as a matter of fact, I've just written an article on this subject entitled, Yes, the Russians are Testing Nuclear Weapons and It's Very Important. We recently, very recently, the director of the Defense Intelligence Agency told the American people in the world that the Russians were probably testing nuclear weapons. My article documented this going back 20 years, involving statements in the United States, official and press reports and official statements in Russian press reports about Russian nuclear testing. And I assess the implications of that compared to our current situation, where we've now had 30 years of changes in our nuclear weapons from the Tesla design, and more are being made as a result of the life extension programs, and we haven't tested these things in the configuration that they are in now, or they will be in the next 10 years.
And Mark, you've got serious technical chops. So to the extent that this has been going on and the U.S. government has relied upon, again, modeling, not experimentation, does that give rise in your mind to a worrying uncertainty about the reliability of these weapons, maybe even their safety?
Well, yes, primarily the reliability, although, you can't completely rule out safety. But I think the threat is almost entirely reliability, because we have weapons which were designed to be extraordinarily safe, and that means using designs that don't have a lot of margin between success and failure. And then we made all these changes in them, and the changes are increasingly being approved. And this is no longer science. It's sort of like practicing medicine. Now you have good doctors and bad doctors. The problem with our nuclear doctors is that they now essentially have zero experience in designing nuclear weapons or testing nuclear weapons. They don't have any experience, and it's quite humbling when you take a weapon you designed out to the test range and detonate it, and you don't get what you expected. Well, yeah, sometimes actually nothing happens, but usually it's a major failure of a type that would result in a dud in a deployed weapon. That's a humbling experience, and the guys who actually did that universally said you needed nuclear testing. And one of the things I documented in the recent article was that the Clinton administration was told exactly that by the national laboratories, that we needed to test. And at a minimum, it had to be in the sub-kiloton range if we wanted to have a reliable nuclear deterrent. And basically, they rejected that advice and lied about it to the Senate. And despite their lies, this is the only arms control treaty ever voted down by a majority of the Senate.
That's the Comprehensive Test Ban Treaty. Yeah, no, it was extraordinary. And a particular credit to Senator John Kyle, who really led that fight, and the much lamented Jim Schlesinger, Dr. Jim Schlesinger, former Secretary of Energy, among other things, was instrumental in helping make that case, and we're desperately in need of it being made now. Mark Schneider, let me ask you, Mark, and I would love to get you back for a longer conversation about all of this, but just in the shortness of time we have today, I did want to turn to China. Because we've been talking, of course, a lot in the course of this program and elsewhere about what China is up to. Our new Committee on the Present Danger, China is very much focused on the military threat as well as the economic one. But give us just a quick sense of what we think we know about what the Chinese are doing in the nuclear weaponry space, besides proving themselves absolutely indifferent to any appeals to have arms control restraints posed upon their forces?
Well, there's no question that they're engaged in a major expansion of their nuclear capabilities. The Director of Defense Intelligence Agency just said that we expect the number of their nuclear weapons to double, and he's talking about strategic mainly, over the next 10 years. Now, there is a great deal of uncertainty about the overall size of the Chinese nuclear arsenal. And the numbers you typically see, 280, 270, 300, a few hundred, that's the low end of the debate. And there are reports of literally up to several thousand Chinese nuclear warheads. Now, whatever the existing number, that's going to go up, and go up a lot, because we see all the programs underway, heavily MIRVed, strategic ballistic missiles are beginning to be deployed, and my belief is they're going to deploy a lot of them. The so-called underground Great Wall, which is 3,000 miles of missile tunnels, makes no sense unless they plan a very large force of mobile ICBMs, and I believe that's exactly what they plan to do.
Mark, this raises a series of very important questions, and we don't have time to address them today, but I know that over the years you have been a strong champion of missile defense for the United States. Do we have a shot now at deterring these kinds of threats by improving our missile defense capabilities very quickly?
I'm sorry to say no. The programs underway right now are not on the scale, and they're not aimed at technically defeating a very high-quality, highly capable Russian threat. In the hypersonic missile area, our senior generals say we have no defense capability. Now, we'll try to do something about that over the next 5 years. But right now, we've got nothing. And overall, missile defense is very important. There are a lot of important pluses of it, but right now and probably never, it's just not going to be a substitute for nuclear deterrence. It's going to be an augmentation of nuclear deterrence.
But we got to get back in the nuclear deterrence business. Mark Schneider, nobody understands that better than you. Thank you for visiting with us from time to time. I hope you will come back to us for a longer conversation. God bless you, my friend.
More with Frank Gaffney.
We're back. It's my real delight to say we are joined by one of the men whose service in uniform I have been most impressed by. He is Captain James Fennell, United States Navy, now retired, alas, a man who worked in various capacities in the United States Navy, usually with a specialization in naval intelligence. In fact, he rose to the rank of being the director of intelligence for the U.S. Pacific Fleet. He is a distinguished fellow of the Center for Security Policy in Geneva, not to be confused with the one in Washington, D.C., and has contributed mightily to my personal education about so many of the issues involved in the challenge posed to us by Communist China through a remarkable group he calls Red Star Rising. Jim Fennell, it's great to have you back. First of all, let me thank you for your leadership on the open letter to President Trump that has got the the Chinese Communist panties in a complete bunch over saying some of the truthful things about the need for the president to stay the course on China. And I salute you for your leadership on that. Well done.
Thank you, Frank. It's glad to be talking to you.
Good. Well, it's our pleasure to have you here. Jim, you, of course, have got background most especially in intelligence matters, naval intelligence especially. But I wanted to pick your brains a little bit about what's going on in Hong Kong at the moment. I know you've been there. I know you've been following closely what's happening there. Give us your sense of what's afoot, what the Chinese communists are likely to do about it, and what are the stakes for us?
Well, I think the world is starting to wake up to the totalitarian control features of the Chinese Communist Party and what they seek to offer the world with a world led by like China. And what they're doing in Hong Kong right now is they're suppressing the freedom and liberty of 7 million people, and they're trying desperately to couch it in terms of they're just trying to maintain order. But the fact of the matter is they're reneging on a deal that they made with the British in 1997 to give the people of Hong Kong 50 years to transition in a system called One Country, Two Systems, where the people of Hong Kong could be allowed to, you know, pick and choose their own leaders and to slowly integrate into the larger People's Republic of China. Clearly, the PRC is not allowing that, and they're afraid, desperately afraid, that this protests there are going to lead to protests in the mainland of China. And so I expect that they're going to use physical force to contain this and to crush it. The question is, how will they do that and what kind of force? I think they want to use a force that will be is not as lethal as they had in Tiananmen Square in 1989. However, the protesters in Hong Kong recognize that if they don't take a stand today and gain the world's attention, that they will be essentially subjects like the 3 million Uyghurs in concentration camps in Western China, or the rest of China, for that matter. And the people of Hong Kong don't want to live under that, and they're not going to go away quietly. And so there's a real tug of war going on right now where the Chinese are trying to characterize these protesters as quote-unquote terrorists. They have people writing articles on a daily basis that are putting out this propaganda from China. And unfortunately, people in the United States, in our academic communities, some folks are buying into this and repeating these things and trying to make the blame to be on these protesters. But that's not the truth. And as we've seen over the weekend with the file footage that the Chinese purposely released showing the People's Armed Police military forces amassing on the border in Shenzhen, they're sending us signals. The Chinese are very clear about sending us their strategic signals. And their strategic signal is, if this continues, we will use physical violence and we will put these people down. They will obey or we will crush them.
Mm-hmm. Jim, I think the evidence is pretty strong now that short of sending in those masses of People's Liberation Army or People's Armed Police units for the purposes of cracking down the old-fashioned way, the Chinese are using undercover operatives, whether they're police units or whether they're PLA units or whether they're thugs or mafiosa triads, whatever, to crack heads and to even incarcerate people, it seems. Do you expect at the end of the day that the Chinese will refrain from using the obvious brute force instruments of their power, which will not play well on television around the world, presumably, in favor of more of this kind of sort of penetration and subversion, if you will, of the protests, maybe for the purposes of provoking, you know, violence by the police against them, but for whatever purpose, as an alternative to the old-fashioned ham-handed kind of force?
Yes, Frank, I think that's exactly what they're doing. They have essentially, the Hong Kong police are not just a constabulary force that's sourced from people in Hong Kong. We now have ample evidence to show that many of the people that are part of the Hong Kong police force are from mainland China. And so the Hong Kong police now are essentially an arm of the People's Armed Police in a different way. And what they're trying to do is to resolve this with the quote-unquote Hong Kong police so that it doesn't look like that the mainland is using brute force to come in across the border from Shenzhen. So that's their deepest desire, is to maintain a picture that shows that they're using restraint. The question becomes, what will these protesters do in terms of, you know, they're kind of not like the 2014 umbrella movement where you had a couple of identified leaders. This group right now is really leaderless. I've heard some folks make this commentary. There isn't one single group or one individual that the Chinese government can negotiate with or kidnap or suppress. It's like they say, they're following the, you know, old Bruce Lee dictum of being like water. And so they're very hard to control and negotiate with. And if a majority of these people that are out on the streets that we saw several weeks ago, a couple million people, it's going to be quite difficult for this Hong Kong police force to control that. And so the real question is what else can these protesters do that are going to draw the ire of Beijing, like we saw this last weekend in the airport? And they seem to have been able to get control of the airport without having really shed too much blood. I mean, I hate to say it that way, but you didn't see pictures coming out of the airport like you did in Tiananmen. And so that's their goal. If they can do that, they can control this. It really comes down to the protesters and how many people they can get out on the street. And that's really an unknown at this point.
Jim Fennell, let me ask you to put this into a broader context. I, like you, and I think quite a number of our team, particularly on the Committee on the Present Danger of China, which I'm very pleased to say you're a founding member of, have been urging the United States to take a more visible, vocal stand in solidarity with the protesters. That seems to me to be both, you know, the morally right thing to do, the historically appropriate thing to do, and the strategically necessary thing to do. But Would you talk a little bit about, knowing the lay of the land, if you will, or the seascape, perhaps more accurately, out there in the Pacific, Jim, why is it important that China be resisted, at least in the political sense, the economic sense, the geostrategic sense, if you will, in what it has in mind for Hong Kong at the moment?
I think we can look at Hong Kong as just a harbinger of the future. If China is able to force these 7 million people to essentially kowtow and obey to the dictates of Beijing and to basically break an agreement that they had signed in 1997 with the United Kingdom on how this transition would occur, then what other agreements has China signed that you can trust? They say they have an agreement with Taiwan. Well, I think the people of Taiwan now clearly know what's next for them. And then you start applying this to other areas. What about all these Belt and Road nations? What will happen to them if similar circumstances arise where China says, I want country X to do such and such? And the people say, well, no, we don't want to do that. Well, now we have a template. And this is the real fear. This is the real concern that we have, is that the People's Republic of China and the Chinese Communist Party are not adherents to freedom and liberty. Okay? That's the fundamental difference. They believe in a one-party rule that says, we tell you what to do and you have to obey. And if you disagree with that, we will put you down, whether it's stealing, taking your money, taking your house, putting your family in prison, watching your social credit. If you jaywalk, we'll take points away from you and you won't be able to travel or buy goods or services. This is the world that they're living or they're promoting. And this is what's happening in Hong Kong. If we're not standing up for this today, it will come to Taiwan. It will come across to other areas where China is dealing. And I think the Belt and Road is a perfect place to think about that because it's such a global enterprise at this point.
Yeah. Jim, my biggest concern, frankly, is that the Chinese Communist Party will take away from what they're seeing in the United States at the moment, most especially, and to varying degrees elsewhere around the world, a sense that they can have carte blanche to deal with Hong Kong as they wish. I'm very, very much of the view, and I think you are as well, that we need to be visibly seen. As I said in a commentary yesterday, we are Hong Kongers would be an important motif for the president and, for that matter, the bipartisan leadership of Congress to enunciate at this time and to make it clear there will be real costs to China, certainly economic and political costs, and we will not be pursuing this fiction of a new trade deal with them if indeed the bad things they have in mind for Hong Kong that you forecast here go down. Jim Fennell, we have to leave it at that. I appreciate so much your time. Thanks so much. Join us again, if you would, in the near future. Next up, we'll be speaking with Michael Cutler about developments on the immigration front and what they might mean for you. Straight ahead.
Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
We're back. I'm very pleased to say, joined by a good friend of this program and a great national resource. He is Michael Cutler. He retired as a senior special agent from what was known then as the Immigration and Naturalization Service, now better known as the Immigration and Customs Enforcement, or ICE, agency. He is, among many other things, a contributor to Front Page magazine and host of his own radio program, the Michael Cutler Hour, heard Friday evenings on Blog Talk Radio. Michael, you've been contributing mightily to the public discourse on so many issues. I want to touch on as many of them as we can today. Welcome back. Good to have you.
Thanks so much for having me. Also working with DML News these days, Dennis Michael Lynch News, so partnering with him also to get the word out, as I'm happy to do with you on your terrific show.
Good to have you again. Let me ask you, Michael, about, first off, the positive news out of the Supreme Court recently concerning President Trump's ability to fund the border wall.
Yeah, that's very, very important. You know, it's interesting. Everyone raises the question about whether or not the military will back up the border patrol along our border. In reality, the mission of immigration enforcement is to back up the military. The common mission of all five branches of our armed forces is to keep our enemies as far from our shores as possible, up close and in person. That task falls to the men and women of the Border Patrol and the ICE agents enforcing the laws from within the interior. So it makes perfect sense for the Supreme Court to say, okay, you can use military funding to secure America's borders against the entry of criminals and potentially America's enemies.
Amen. Amen. And high time they did it. Speaking of Immigration and Customs Enforcement, or ICE, and Interior Enforcement, of course, there's been a lot of thrashing around going on late over so-called raids by ICE. The president talked them up before they happened. Now that a few of them have happened, notably in Mississippi, there's been much consternation on the part of those who seem to feel as though they have to protect the illegal aliens in our country rather than American citizens. Talk to us about what's going on there, Michael.
Well, as an INS agent, I participated in many so-called raids. This should be another day in the life of the United States. How this becomes a headline is beyond me. I actually disagreed with the president when he said, well, we're going to hold the raids, we're not going to hold the raids. You don't hold law enforcement in abeyance to achieve political goals. I'm sorry, I'm a big fan of the president's, but I thought that was wrong. And let's remember that before the Second World War, the enforcement of the immigration laws was basically vested in the Labor Department, the idea being to protect the wages and jobs of American workers. True politicians who would represent Americans should be thrilled when immigration agents remove illegal aliens from their jobs so that Americans can replace them. The meatpacking industry is particularly onerous. 30 years ago, the average wage within the meatpacking industry was between $18 to $20 an hour back then. Now the Democrats are promising, we're going to get you $15 an hour as a minimum wage. Goodness, by now they should be paying at least $30 an hour in that industry, except for the fact that many of the jobs are done by illegal aliens. The average wage today in the meatpacking industry is under $11 per hour. This is exploitation. There's no compassion in exploitation. And there's one other factor I have to throw in. You know, I worry about terrorism, as I know you do. We focus on that a lot, and we need to. I've been told by scientists it's difficult to poison reservoirs. There's so much water, and the cleansing process that we use to purify the water would remove many of the poisons. Food processing, on the other hand, provides all too many opportunities for bad actors to poison lots of people. And by the way, the imagery of the children being of the children of the aliens arrested crying, why does the media not go to the homes of people who are arrested for other law violations, let's say failure to pay taxes or failure to pay parking tickets, and they get arrested? I assure you the children are wailing no less, dramatically. Why are we not concerned about that? You know, Nancy Pelosi talks about a climate of fear created by immigration enforcement, which has led, by the way, to a bullet, I believe, being fired into a Texas ICE office overnight. Think about that. They are vilifying immigration agents, talking about a climate of fear. Is not that the stock and trade of all law enforcement, particularly the IRS? Isn't that why before April 15th, you see massive arrests of people not paying taxes? Have you ever heard Pelosi complain about that climate of fear?
No, not so much. And let me ask you, speaking about that incident with a bullet being fired into an ICE office, it, I believe, is a space that has been let by a company called Geo Group to support ICE. Their general counsel was, I guess the technical term for it these days is doxed yesterday by agitators in Florida who named where his kids lived, where he went to church, and other particulars of his private life. And it was clearly for the purposes of threatening him and his company and his coworkers. And surprise, surprise, a day later, the office of that very same company, it was physically assaulted in San Antonio. As a guy who, you know, wore the badge and did this kind of hard work, Michael Cutler, what do you say?
Infuriating. Look, they have vilified, the radical left has vilified law enforcement in general, ICE in particular. You want to talk about calls to violence? It's the people who are attacking people that put their lives on the line to defend America who are facing violence because of the left-wing nutcases and Antifa. So, you know, there's plenty of blame to go around, you know, the radical left, the radical right. I don't like the radical anything. We should all come together as Americans. And this is why it's so important. The final point that I did want to make today before we run out of time, because time is always too fleeting and precious on your program. An individual was just charged with a translator who had worked for the U.S. military, an interpreter, charged with alien smuggling. The United States government gave this guy a green card because of his service to America. He's a citizen of Afghanistan. What's disturbing, and I've worked with many translators during my career, is they become the eyes, ears, and mouth, if you will, of the agents, of intelligence officers, and of cooperators and informants. They get to see the documents. If they lie about what the person is saying, they could mislead the investigators, law enforcement. They could put people's lives at risk. They could prevent us from finding out about attacks before they're going to happen, especially in the military. So here's a guy who had a trusted position, comes back, starts smuggling aliens from the Middle East through Brazil into the United States, one of whom was another translator, or interpreter, rather, which is a higher position, who also had been denied employment. He was fired by the military, barred from entering military bases out of security concerns. This is who this other guy was trying to smuggle into the United States. This is a game of who do you trust, going back to the old Johnny Carson program. And we seem to not understand as a country that the vetting process is so critical. You have all these politicians saying, let's legalize millions of illegal aliens. I could tell you that would be catastrophic for national security, because there's no effective way to vet that many people in any kind of a reasonable time frame.
Right. This is important on so many different levels. I think particularly as we're looking at the imminent surrender of Afghanistan to the Taliban, there will almost certainly be a lot more people who will be applying to come here, and a lot of people interested in trying to help them get here, by the way. And the absence of this kind of vetting, it's really a disaster in the making.
Right. And we had another case involving an individual from Pakistan by the name of Sharafat Ali Khan, who similarly was smuggling aliens from the Middle East through Brazil. Brazil, of course, has the tri-border region, which has training camps for Hezbollah, Hamas, and possibly ISIS and Al-Qaeda. And one of those people was actually a member of the Taliban, brought into the United States by that other alien smuggler operating at the behest of Pakistani smuggling organizations, as did this interpreter. He was linked to a similar Pakistan-Afghani-based alien smuggling ring, moving people from the Middle East into the United States. This is a threat to national security. How can anyone argue whether or not that border must be secured?
Well, let me ask you about one other thing before we have to let you go, Michael, and you're right, as a radio guy, you know how fleeting the time is. But quickly, you've written a powerful piece at Front Page Magazine about the left's immigration con job. And you have, among other things, an interesting turn of phrase there that, you know, we're watching the weaponization of compassion. Talk about that as the instrument for the con job's perpetration.
Well, you know, con artists are people that get into people's lives by conning them, by conniving and lying to them and deceiving them. And Bernie Madoff, of course, great example. So smart people can fall victim to this con job. Compassionate Americans who feel bad for the children, feel bad for the guy washing dishes in the back of a diner. And then, you know, ICE agents are vilified. They're going after the brown skin, just like about the public charge business. Our laws have nothing to do with the person's skin color or race or religion. If they did, I couldn't have enforced the laws for 30 seconds, let alone 30 years. So people are being convinced this is about racism and bigotry. It's not. It's about keeping out aliens who are threats to national security, public health.
We have to leave it at that. Michael Cutler, hard out of time. Thank you very much for your visit with us today, and come back to us again tomorrow. Same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.